But not highly likely, and it's more of an initial savings of a very limited supply of COVID-19 tests. So my guess is that they're not going to kind of go through that too much as the test supplies go out. And also, the test supplies are reflected to a degree on the ridiculously large number of cases in New York State. We happen to be one of the more aggressive testing states in the union, so probably other states, if they tested as much as we did, would probably have a higher than reported case load, but that's another subject.
K2NDB.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, Roy, this is to your first story about the rapid test. Do you have an opinion on how likely this is really, viable, or maybe you don't know any more than, or just so you don't know if you don't know, do you think it's likely the real deal? Back to you, Roy.
I believe it's a real deal. It's a major laboratory testing company. The technology is repurposed from one that they already use for strep throat and other tests. So I think it's legit. Whether they can crank it up as high as they suggest might be difficult. I don't know the type of reagents and the supply chain that the reagents have. It might not be readily available in the vast number that they would need. But I believe in principle that the equipment should function as they report.
Very good. Makes me happy. Gives me a little ray of hope there. So, thanks, Roy. Back to Annette.
Okay, very good, Bob. And the more testing, the better. The ability to have a good idea and to map across the country people with either symptomatic or totally asymptomatic infections would give us a much better ability to fine-tune the social distancing and make it possible to a degree of unshackling the economy a little bit here, a little bit there. But without that knowledge, doing it haphazardly, doing it based on assumptions is very dangerous and can lead to even more problems down the road. So I'm optimistic about it. Again, I don't know if they'll be able to scale it up as much as they're saying, but I hope they will.
Me too. KD2NBB, back to Ned.
AC2GS. Okay, as I touched upon earlier, an Arizona man has died and his wife is in critical condition after listening to the president promote an anti-malarial drug, chloroquine, as a treatment for the novel coronavirus and deciding to take some themselves, CNN reported this past Monday evening. Trump has repeatedly brought up chloroquine as possibly being a very powerful treatment for the virus on the basis of a small French study, despite warnings from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease Director, Dr. Anthony Fauci, that its use is unproven and based on only anecdotal data. Per NBC News, the woman in critical care said she and her husband were afraid of getting sick and attempted to medicate themselves with chloroquine after seeing President Trump discuss the medication on television. The two actually took a treatment for parasitic infestations in their aquarium, which were listed as chloroquine phosphate as the active ingredient. And it was only in the residence because they had once owned koi fish. Chloroquine can be extremely toxic when administered under the supervision of a physician. When not administered under the supervision of a physician, dosages as low as 2 grams can be fatal, and it has a variety of severe side effects. In a statement to media, Hospital System Banner Health wrote that the couple, who are in their 60s, ingested the drug and within a half hour, quote, experienced immediate effects requiring admittance to a nearby Banner Health hospital. Let me drop for a sec. As Slate noted, Trump tweeted last Saturday that he believes hydroxychloroquine, a less toxic analog of the drug, should be, quote, put in use immediately. And this past Tuesday, he linked an article citing a man who believed hydroxychloroquine helped him beat the coronavirus. While laboratory research has found the drug to be effective in related coronaviruses that cause severe acute respiratory syndrome, the CDC and the World Health Organization are still studying whether the same is true for the current outbreak of SARS-CoV-2, otherwise known as COVID-19. And the disease that it causes. Currently, the drug is only allowed to be used for coronavirus treatment in the U.S. on compassionate grounds, meaning that a doctor is out of proven options to assist the patient, and both have agreed to take on the risk of an unproven treatment. In an interview with NBC News' Vaughn Hilliard, the woman in question affirmed that she had heard the Food and Drug Administration had not approved the drug, but she quoted as remarking during this interview that, quote, Trump kept saying it was basically pretty much a cure. Oh, my God, don't take anything. Don't believe anything. Don't believe anything the president says and his people because they don't know what they're talking about. This is a heartache I'll never get over, end quote. Dr. Daniel Brooks, medical director for Banner Health Poison and Drug Information Center, wrote in a statement that the last thing that we want right now is to inundate our emergency departments with patients who believe they found a vague and risky solution that could potentially jeopardize their health. We are strongly urging the medical community to not prescribe this medication to any non-hospitalized patients. Don't take any medicines on your own. Don't take any fish medications on your own. You're not a fish. Keep in mind, though, that I got a very strange message on my cell phone that urged me as a doctor to sign some kind of a request for the president to immediately open use of hydroxychloroquine for any case of coronavirus. And when I back-checked where that came from, it was from the same people who bankroll Breitbart for some strange, strange reason, the Mercer family. So, anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments on this particular subject. This is AC2GS. Okay, well, going on to the statistics. The numbers have more than doubled since I mentioned them last week, and the United States is in the not enviable position of number one in most confirmed cases of COVID-19. The last time I checked the statistics, which was about an hour ago, and I'm sure it's higher now, there are over 704,401 detected cases spread over 199 countries and territories. There have been 33,226 reported deaths related to this virus. The World Health Organization believes that the COVID-19 virus's mortality rate is somewhere around 3.4 as of the beginning of March, although a lot of epidemiologists seem to think that it's something like 2.0 or hopefully less. Keep in mind, again, that influenza's mortality rate is 0.1. So that's a lot more. COVID is a lot more than influenza. This first preliminary description of outcomes among patients with COVID-19 in the United States also indicates that fatality was highest in people over the age of 85. The mortality ranges anywhere from 10 to 27% for that group, followed by 3 to 11% among people 65 to 85 years of age, and 1 to 3% among people 55 to 64 years of age, with less than 1% among people aged 20 to 54, and thankfully no fatalities among persons under 19 years of age. The rate of infection has slowed a lot in China. According to them, they only had 45 new cases in the past 24 hours. Here in the United States, we have had 133,039 cases, with 2,362 deaths. Keep in mind, again, that just last week, that was 32,783 cases and only 416 deaths. New York State is almost half of the present cases, with 59,513, with 965 deaths. Let me drop for a sec.
ACTIS query.
Yes, Bill.
You were just covering numbers and more than doubling from previous week, but have you noticed the numbers from the United States total cases over the past couple of days, 2 or 3 days? It looks like those numbers are no longer showing exponential growth, but linear growth. Just wondering what you thought about AC2IS.
Very often, if you take a look at any of these curves, you'll see that there's basically three stages at minimum. Sometimes there are multiple versions of the three stages. Initially, when the infection just starts off, you get exponential. Then as you infect the local population, because you can't reinfect people who are already infected, it takes on more of a linear curve. And then finally, the slope edges down to the point that you hit a peak, and then you drop down the other side of the curve. Now, once again, you could go through multiple cycles like that. A lot of times, seasonal variations can cause that. Other times, people's behavior, where they kind of say, okay, the worst is over, we can now relax everything, and then it takes off again. So that's a good sign, but it's a little premature. Also, the United States is probably going to experience multiple geographic peaks. So we'll have, New York will kind of be the first person over the cliff, followed by probably, I would guess, Louisiana, followed by Florida, and then followed by probably Chicago. It'll be sort of superimposed peaks on because of the depth and breadth of this country when it comes to these things. But, it's a good sign that it's going from, obviously, from geometric logarithmic to a linear progression.
I was wondering if you caught, it seems like the New York City numbers have been approximating linear growth for the past more than a week, maybe 10 days, which maybe correlates with, sort of self-isolation and whatever being requested or demanded in New York. But I thought this was kind of the same across the country, and I'm not seeing anything like that in other states. It seems like every place else is still exponential, and maybe this latest flattening is strictly due to the New York City numbers. It's just hard for me to really tell. AC2IS.
I would think because the reported cases, almost 50%, are in the metropolitan area, that's exactly what's happening. We're in a way ahead of the curve, temporally speaking. We're one of the earliest centers of infection and the infection rate is, I wouldn't say it's flattened yet. I wish it was. It's gone from logarithmic to linear. Then from linear, eventually it'll peak. That they're suggesting that the New York area will reach a peak, hopefully, in about a week or two, which is going to wreak havoc with the hospital system, but then hopefully it'll go down. Governor Cuomo has kind of suggested that his epidemiologists are looking somewhat optimistically in hospitalization numbers. The rate of them is experiencing a little bit of a decline to give us a good picture. But again, my sense of this is that different areas of the country are going to be affected almost equally, but at different times. So you will see a linear curve in New York where you see a exponential curve in Louisiana. We'll all get to the other end of the curve. It's just we'll be doing it at a different time. So I think that's what's going on.
And are you thinking that the linear progression of confirmed cases in New York reflects actually what's going on, or do you think that reflects more the change in testing in New York where they are just no longer aggressively testing AC2IS?
I don't know if I would characterize it as they're no longer actively testing. The problem is the number of tests. They kind of went through what they had, and unfortunately they are constricting the requirements so that they don't run out of it for hospitalized people. And hopefully with all these commercial companies gearing up, there'll be a continued large number. New York State has been a major tester in the country, and probably why the numbers read as big as they do. I'm sure as the tests are generally available, New York State will go back to their previous practice of giving anyone who needs it a test, as well as the rest of the country will gear up. But the problem is going to be there are areas in the country where they don't test, so they don't see it, so they're not afraid of it, so they don't want to do anything about it. And those are going to be set up for something really bad happening in probably about 2-3 weeks. And, you know, the problem is that you can't turn back the clock. So I think that testing will, in the long run, go up and not be constricted. I think this is a temporary problem with supply, as we're having a problem with the supply of everything else.
Are you thinking about the data out of China? There are, I can't tell really what's going on there. They're effectively reporting no new confirmed cases, but they're also saying things like positive test results don't get counted as quote-unquote confirmed cases if those cases are mild. All kinds of things to be able to say that they have no new cases. And there are some people, kind of sort of like anti-China news sources that are claiming that things are just going to explode in China again because they're more attempting to sweep things under the rug than they are trying to treat the issue, AC2IS.
Yeah, Bill, there's a lot of, unfortunately, politics involved in this. And I don't know, there's a lot of countries' numbers that I sort of don't believe. And I can't definitively tell you if it's just due to lack of the ability to test, lack to coordinate the information, lack to share it with the rest of the world. There are a lot of people who are very upset, rightly, with the Chinese. They did initially lock things down and shut people up. One of the first doctors who issued a cry out there about what was going on was brought down to the police department and had to sign a little note saying he wouldn't do it again, and sent back to the hospital to work. And he was a 35-year-old ophthalmologist. You wouldn't think that puts you at a high risk, but he died of COVID-19. So there's a lot of terrible things that they do, and it's an authoritarian state. They lock people up. They well people into rooms. They put them in isolation hotels that are not able to sustain people, so the hotel falls down and a whole bunch of people get injured and killed. It's kind of a mess. And there are other people who look at the numbers and other numbers and are very suspicious. They're very suspicious of the number of portable crematoriums that supposedly got rolled into Wuhan, and wonder why the number of dead doesn't seem to overload normal city's ability to deal with it, but it seemed to do that. They even look at the cell phone numbers. Cell phone companies publish their subscriber numbers, and it dropped 21 million in the last 3 months. And a lot of people are looking at that and saying, that's not from a bunch of people who decided not to use a cell phone, because pretty much in China, everyone uses a cell phone. That's how you pay your bills. That's how you do a lot of things there. They're suggesting that some of those millions went the way of all things, and it's being underreported. Now, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever truly know. You know, that's the problem with authoritarian states. I don't know what's going on in Russia either. If you look at the statistics, Russia is having a wonderful time. And if you read the Chinese statistics, as I mentioned, they're in the 40s. That's not too bad. But you'll notice that they haven't opened up Wuhan yet. They haven't really released anything. They keep saying that they're going to. So I tend to think that something they're not mentioning is going on there. But I could be wrong.
Right, back to you. Thanks, AC2IS.
Okay, very well. Let me continue with my little thing on COVID. Available test kits in the United States have jumped to the point that the United States has one of the highest absolute numbers of test results. Although corrected for our population, we do not have the highest per capita test numbers. There are regional differences in the number of test kits available in the United States, and to a degree, this is one of the reasons for New York City's higher number of COVID-19 cases. Crucial medical supplies are experiencing dangerous shortages. Protective gear for frontline health care providers is being stretched beyond the point of common sense safety issues, placing our limited resources of health care providers at risk of becoming infected as well. Ventilators are in very short supply, and some hospitals are experimenting with hooking more than one person up to the same ventilator simultaneously. Now, this is not without its own risk to the patients being parallel linked together, especially when you consider that the people with viral pneumonias often are complicated with secondary bacterial pneumonias as well. Loosening social distancing as allowing life as usual to return prematurely might be less dangerous if we had enough test kits and a public health corps large enough to blanket this country and provide near real-time data of regional infection rates. So at this point, we do not possess enough test kits, nor the corps of public health care workers, nor the infrastructure to process that data necessary. And for you guys out there who think that the country with low population densities are somehow safe, remember that human beings are, by our nature, social creatures. And even in areas of low population density, tend to coalesce together in bars, restaurants, and places of worship. So please, before you spread your so-called common sense opinions, read a damn book about the 1917-1920 Spanish flu pandemic. All the mistakes and the stupid ideas that people have right now were tried and failed abysmally back in that time. That's it for tonight with that. Stay tuned. It's still going to get worse before it gets better, and we're in for a bit of a bumpy ride. But this is AC2GS. If anyone has any questions about any aspect of COVID-19 and our virus problem, feel free. This is the time.
Net control?
Yes.
I have a question that's a little confusing to me. I spoke with a girl upstairs who is an emergency room nurse at a hospital in the North Bronx. KC2VCT, by the way, sorry. And she said that they're sort of triaging and that, you know, typically the people that are coming in for the complaining of the virus are not getting to the ER. Let me drop. And so where my confusion comes in with is the amount of PPE that's needed if for the people that are working in the general hospital population, and I again got the impression from her that the COVID people are being kept on certain floors or certain areas, so they're not in with the general population. Why are they going through so many masks? like they said today, 300,000 masks in one hospital that usually uses 30,000, that's kind of a big jump.
Well, I assume most of that are either treating COVID-19 patients or those at somewhat high risk for COVID-19. I don't know the mechanism that hospital has. Some hospitals have designed things so that there is sometimes they call it blue and red, sometimes they call it hot and cold, a COVID-free area and a non-COVID-free area. And sometimes they set up these little bivouac tents to do screening inside the tents, although there's usually some area that they have to bring them into a portion of the emergency room because those tents probably are not places that they can run respirators and such. So there's probably a little bit of crossover. I would assume the need for all this protective gear is in dealing with the infected people and making sure, you know, which one is and which one isn't. So I assume they're using a lot of them in that tent that's next to the hospital as well.
Well, it just seems like a big jump considering the actual amount of cases compared to, and I understand testing and all that, you know, I do safety and sanitation for food service, so I know all about the cross-contamination concept, but this whole need for so many things, if the people, not everybody that goes into the hospital has the COVID, that's the part that I kind of thought about.
Well, that's right, although they have kind of shut down the elective services. Elective surgery is not being done. A lot of things that routinely are done in most hospitals are being shut down. And some hospitals are operating at something like 125% of their usual occupancy. I don't know why any hospital would falsify any of this. I have heard and seen enough people crying out for the fact that they're reusing their PPE. Which is problematic, but, you know, if you have to, you have to. You're supposed to remove them between each infected patient, but they've been wearing sometimes the same thing day in and day out. They've been dousing it in isopropyl alcohol to sterilize it and reusing it and completely off, you know, it's not the way it's supposed to be done, but they're stuck. And so I don't think they're making this all up.
I didn't say they're making it up. I just think if so many people, like you say, elective surgery is not happening, so basically it would be people going into an ER or, you know, that's already in the hospital that, you know, I just was surprised when I started thinking about it that not, you know, if 50% of the people in the hospital are not COVID, then I don't know. I just was concerned, couldn't figure out why they're all of a sudden going through so much. And people making masks out of cotton over here, taking, you know, an hour to make a mask that's going to get thrown away after it's used. Kind of just why they're not cleaned and reused. If soap washes your hands and takes care of it, why they wouldn't just wash in boiling water and, you know, use soap and whatever. Vinegar, if they had to, whatever, alcohol. That's just the part that I'm confused by.
Okay, well, I mean, if you pass by most hospitals these days, unfortunately, early in the day, there seems to be a very, very, very long line of people waiting to be tested for the COVID virus. So they're putting a great strain on just about every facility that I'm aware of, you know, in the metropolitan area. And there's two types of masks that gets kind of confused with people. There's the cloth masks, which are relatively inexpensive and don't protect pretty much anyone from COVID-19. COVID-19 is a virus. It's approximately 120 nanometers in diameter, and it goes right through fabric. So the cloth filter has some benefit in people who are infected. If they cough, most of the droplets are caught in the cloth and aren't aerosolized. Also, for those people who aren't infected, it's kind of a mnemonic reminder not to touch your face with your hands, which is another route of infection. The type of masks that are actually effective are designated N95. N is in November, 95. They will take approximately 95% of all viral particles and trap them in a filter. And the filter gets exhausted. It gets clogged up. You can't just kind of rinse it out. People are doing that because they have no choice. If people want to do it, and what they tend to do is they tend to soak it in things like 70% isopropyl alcohol because that tends to kill the virus. But still, you're stuck with the same situation that the N95 filter gets clogged up and it gets very difficult to breathe through, and the cloth mask is of limited benefit, shall we say.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions about COVID-19 tonight?
Into our queue.
Yes, Lou.
We are all supposed to be using soap and water for washing and stuff like that. Question was about Cetaphil. Does that have the same properties in this case as regular soap?
I'm not quite sure what you, Cetaphil?
Yes, it can be used as a cleanser, very mild for people with sensitive skin, but I'm told it doesn't really suds.
Okay, well, I'm not really familiar with that product. The point of the exercise is that the viral particles have a lipid layer, basically a glorified soap bubble. And soap-like material, detergent-like material, will dissolve it and make it disappear. I think Cetaphil is more of a moisturizer, which is not quite the same. So what you need is something with a detergent action. Now, after the detergent action, you can apply a moisturizer secondarily so that your skin doesn't dry out because the soap will inevitably wash away the natural body oils that we produce in our sebaceous glands and such to give our hands moisture. So I tend to think that the product that you're talking about is more of a moisturizing agent than an actual soap detergent one.
Okay, we'll have to look more on that. It's used in two ways that I know of. One is with water as a soap substitute, but it also says on the container that it can be used without water. So it really leaves us confused, and I have two family members who use it because they're very sensitive. Thanks, Roy. And to our queue.
Okay, very good, Lou. I will do further research. Yeah, it's described as a soap-free cleanser. So, I don't know what to tell you, but I would kind of go with regular soap and then a secondary dry your hands and apply a moisturizer just to be on the safe side. These are kind of dangerous times, so belt and suspenders, I think, are preferred.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I have these, construction masks. So, in the beginning when this started, I didn't wear it. I just went to the store, And then as all the information came out, time to wear some kind of a mask. And I noticed that by doing that, people have a tendency to stay a little further away from you. Either they're respecting that you know, that you're paying attention to this, and they keep it at 6 feet, or they might think that you have the bug, and they don't want to go near you. Either way, I notice people tend to stay a little further away. I know the information is out there, and more people are more knowledgeable about it, but if you look around, as you walk through a store, people without the mask, they tend to walk right on top of each other. You know, I mean, it's just something I've noticed. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. I can understand that. Again, some people are using the mask primarily as a memory type of thing to trigger their own memory to not touch their face with their hands. But it's kind of a flag for most people. No one's quite sure whether you're doing it because you're trying to protect yourself or because you're trying to protect them. So they're being overly cautious. It's probably more of a subconscious reflex on the part of many of those people. But I can understand why they would feel that way. But I think you're doing the right thing. Again, is it as effective as an N95? I assume not, but you know, whatever works for you.
Okay, and I did hear one quick report. They were approving them for some of the hospital workers. That went by real quick, so I don't know how true that is. But I could see that, you know. I guess they don't have the N95s. Somebody must think that that's better than nothing, but as you know, it's not. You know, this virus is not an aerosol. You know, in other words, if you spray, like, let's say, a perfume, you know, and you walk into a room later, you could smell that perfume. If you had an N95 mask on, I mean, would you still smell that? I mean, how fine is this? Is this virus? Why, you know, if it's as small as you're saying, how come it's not as small as a hairspray smell, or you know, why isn't it like an aerosol? I mean, it's good that it's not. Back to you, Roy.
Well, Paul, it's not the size that determines it. There are other things. There are viruses that can stay suspended in the air and nebulize and just aerosolize and stay and infect an area for a long time. They did some preliminary studies where they artificially kept the droplets from falling. And it was viable for as long as 3 hours under those very weird circumstances. But for the most part, these things fall out of suspension and land on sticky surfaces and stay there, depending upon the type of surface, for anywhere from 3 or 4 hours for copper to a day for cardboard to a few days for plastic and such. The thing, though, is that you have to understand the scale of what's going on. The aromas, the aromatic compounds that you smell when people spray things that smell are basically one molecule large. They could be as few as 20 atoms together, whereas a virus is a relatively complicated structure with a long RNA strand in the middle, and some proteins packed in with it, and then a lipid layer, and then those protein spikes. So it's a lot of different, very large organic molecules taking up a lot of space, as opposed to a simple benzene derivative, which is what we smell most of the time when we spray things.
NY2H?
Yes, Lou?
I heard that if you have the virus and you use a CPAP machine, that the CPAP machine can aerosol the shedding.
Yes, it can, but again, it doesn't last very long. So it is an increased risk, unfortunately, but it doesn't. suspension forever. How long it does, I don't know if they've done any particular studies. I mean, the only study that I'm aware of is where they really kind of bent all the rules and made it artificially stay in suspension, and it was viable for 3 hours. So I'm assuming that under just tap, those aerosolized viral particles have a relatively shorter viability.
WB2AHK. All right, you turn it to me, WB2AHK.
What's your first name?
I'm Chester, Chet. Chet.
Chester, go ahead.
All right, well, just a question. I work in the school system. I'm not a teacher, but I got to enter the school, and there's fingerprint machines, and you put your finger on it, and you have to push a whole bunch of series of ID numbers, then you go inside. Just to open the door, you have to do that. And then when you go in, you have to punch in, you know, pushing the buttons and so on. And they have never had anything there nearby, and I've been in the habit of going into the bathroom and getting water and rubbing the machine clean. Of course, that won't do much, but lately, just before the school closed, they put a bottle of Purell near one of them. I have heard that Purell is no good. It doesn't kill the virus. Have you heard anything about Purell? Over.
Not 100% sure. Most studies have kind of demonstrated that a 70% isopropyl alcohol content should kill the virus. I would assume that Purell is similar to those. I might be wrong. It's very easy, by the way, to make your own product, you know, instead of pay the ridiculous sum of money that some hoarders are doing. You just take 70% isopropyl alcohol, and then if you want to, you can mix a little glycerin in it as a moisturizer, because the alcohol will dry out your hands. But I'm not 100% sure about the Purell. I assume that their formulation was similar to all the others.
All right. Okay, Roy. I had heard when the whole thing started a few weeks ago that they were saying Purell was ineffective. But I'll read the ingredients on one and see if it has that 70% isopropyl alcohol in it. And then I'll use the Purell before I touch those machines if I have to go back to school. I'm a little worried about those machines. Thanks very much, Dr. Roy. WB2AHK.
Okay, very good, Chester. I wish you good luck. Anyone else with any comments or questions tonight on the on this unfortunate coronavirus situation that we have?
W2HL. I just want to say, as a matter of fact, I have a bottle of Purell, and it says 62% ethyl alcohol.
Okay, then that should kill most germs. So the problem, unfortunately, is there are some hand sanitizers that use they're so-called alcohol-free sanitizers. They use things called ammonium compounds instead of alcohol, and those are probably the ones that shouldn't be used for these circumstances. But anything with anywhere from 60 to 95% either isopropyl or ethyl alcohol should be fine. Usually 70% is a very nice amount. A little bit of water in there seems to kind of break up the cell membranes better than even 95% alcohol. So you should be good with it then. Yes, Bob.
Yeah,
if I have a bottle of what is claims to be 99% alcohol, isopropyl alcohol, I didn't think alcohol could even stay that concentrated with air. But anyhow, it, I guess it's at least... what if you just mix it with just a tad of water to knock it down to 70? I assume that could be the same kind of thing as 70% bacteroid.
Yeah, Bob, that's the easiest way. You just put in enough water to make it 70%, and that should be the optimum. I mean, theoretically, you could manufacture alcohols to be anything up to 100%. It costs more money to manufacture it at those high percentages, but it's certainly doable. But yeah, I would knock it down to 70%. That seems to be the sweet spot, at least in most of the literature that I've been reading.
Very good. That means I get a little more of the cleaning. It gives me a little more alcohol, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's nice to know you can actually stretch things instead of be out of things. So, yeah. No problem with 70%. Any other questions or comments or anything about COVID-19 tonight? I know there was some early talk about non-chemical methods of sterilizing. As I mentioned before, one of the very popular ones being used is to douse things in 70% isopropyl alcohol. They're using that for fabric and plastic masks, even though they're not terribly effective for the virus as N95s are, but they're still doing them. So you can use isopropyl alcohol. You can also, if you're a tinkerer, ozone is an effective antibacterial substance, as is if you have a antimicrobial ultraviolet C-class light source. It's good for the surface. It's not really that great for masks because the rest of the material in the mask is blocked, and also the ultraviolet C will start to break down the plastic. As to a degree, will the ozone break down the plastic in regular masks? Whereas isopropyl alcohol is very well tolerated by cellulose and by fabric and plastics and such. So the isopropyl alcohol is probably a little bit better than using the ozone or certainly the UVC light. But any other questions you want to ask, please feel free.
W2HO.
Yes, Howard.
Yeah, good evening, Roy, and everybody. My friend would like to ask a question, third party. His name is Barry. He is Barry.
Hello, Dr. Roy. I heard there's a new, well, not new, it's been around for a while, but they have a thing called convalescent plasma that they take from corona patients, and they use that as a therapy, and I heard within hours people recover. I'm talking bad cases. What do you think about that?
Welcome, Barry. I haven't heard anything about that yet. It sort of makes sense in a way. The problem is finding a source for it, I would guess, because you have to find people who have had the infection and have resolved the infection and now have antibodies. And if you're able to selectively spin down their antibodies without getting antibodies to something else that the person has of themselves, you know, like different blood types and such, it might offer some benefit, but I would think that that's a kind of a very difficult to arrange and problematic treatment protocol. But that's interesting to hear. If you've got any sources on that, and you can email them to me, please. You can just send it to mailbag@ac2gs.com, and I'd love to read it.
There was also something that I read. This is way back. Maybe a century or two ago,
when they had slaves. There was a guy in Massachusetts who was a slave, but his slave master, you know, treated him well, and he noticed that the guy was, you know, he was pretty smart. And the black slave said to his master, he says, I have a way to get rid of this smallpox epidemic. And what he did was, he said that someone infected with smallpox, you know, they would get blisters, and he says, when you put the substance from the blister onto another person, an open cut, the antibodies would go in. I mean, that sounds gross, but the antibodies would go into the person's cut and actually inoculate the person from the smallpox, and I heard it worked.
I don't exactly know what to tell you because I never heard that particular story. Massachusetts wasn't actually a slave state, so I don't know exactly what he was doing in Massachusetts. A smallpox vaccine is kind of the first progenitor of all vaccinations. It was discovered by Edward Jenner back in 1796. It doesn't use that principle at all, thank God, because there's no antibodies in those pustules. Those pustules contain three viruses and would simply is the means that people give each other smallpox. That's how it infects other people. The method that was finally found by Edward Jenner was to give someone a close relative of smallpox, a variation that affected cows for the most part and barely gave any human beings any real problems. And so they would inoculate the people with cowpox virus, and it was rather easy for human beings to fight off a cowpox, and the immunity that they got from fighting off the easier cowpox protected them from smallpox. So I think it's more of an apocryphal story, if you ask me.
I'm sorry, that's what it was. Now you reminded me. The guy, actually, he ran away from the South and somehow came up to the North in Massachusetts. And what happened was people infected with the cowpox, they had blisters on their hands, and he said one way of inoculating people was to spread the cowpox pus from one person to the other, an open cut. And that would immunize the person from the smallpox. And now you just jogged my memory on that one, okay?
Okay, I mean, that makes sense. That's what was done. Again, back in the 18th century, Edward Jenner discovered that in England. And probably the same way. I don't know about your story of the slave that came up with it in Massachusetts, but Edward Jenner came up with it in England. But that makes much more sense because you're not. It has nothing to do with antibodies. It has to do with the actual virus. So by taking the cowpox pustules, you're basically inoculating people with a less dangerous infectious process. And luckily, it's close enough that your immune system has no problem, once it's able to deal with cowpox, to deal with the smallpox, which killed many, many people in the olden days. And people had all kinds of very strange ideas of how to treat smallpox. They had these treaties where they suggested that people wrap themselves in red flannel for some reason and put them near the fireplace. You know, back in those days, you did anything just in case it might work.
Yeah, the idea was, even with a lot of inoculations today, like rabies or something like that, what they did was they dried up the rabies bacterium or whatever it was, and then injected a lesser form into the person, which built up the antibodies. And so maybe, in some way, maybe we could take a flu virus and lessen its efficacy and then, you know, lessen its potency and then maybe inject that into a person or infect a person with that in order to fight against this thing. Who knows?
Well, Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the major purposes of vaccination. There's the activated vaccines in which the viruses have been ripped apart into little pieces. There are attenuated vaccines in which they've been damaged or modified enough to be less aggressive. And then in the cases of smallpox, those are live vaccines. So there's three major groups. Rabies is a virus, so it's the same principle. Everyone's kind of running around looking for them. There have been 20 proposed vaccines that want to start studies to see whether they are safe and whether they are effective. There is one study that kind of shot past animal safety protocols and went directly into, I think it was 64 young, healthy people getting these injections, and I hope nothing terrible happens to them, using a very new technique that actually used the genetic code that was discovered by the Chinese early in this infection, used to fashion a vaccine type. The benefit of that is that the turnover rate from the virus genome to a vaccine is relatively short. They were able to do it in 2-3 months. The only problem is they haven't shown whether this method of producing vaccines produces any immunity in the people taking these vaccines. So this is something that they're going to be investigating once they make sure that it's relatively safe. They're going to have to find if it's effective. And then if it's effective, they'll have to figure out how to scale it up to millions and millions of people. So unfortunately, even though it's fast-tracked, the most optimistic view I've heard on a vaccination for this is a year and a half. And as I've mentioned before, there are some viruses that are not very easy to form vaccines to. HIV. They've been working on a vaccine for HIV for at least 20 years that I know of, and they still haven't quite gotten it right. So not all viruses are amenable to vaccination techniques. So we'll have to see what happens.
Well, just a word to the wise. I delve into this type of information. There's a guy in Israel, independent a scientist, and he came up with a thing. He was talking about the HIV virus, and he said it seems to work with what they have with the cocktails. The cocktails are designed because the HIV virus mutates and it escapes the original therapy that they give it. So they have a multiple therapy that they use in order to go after that virus. And so he's working with cancer. He claims that there's a thing called Mutato, M-U-T-A-T-O, Mutato. And this thing actually works like the HIV virus, and it goes after the cancer. He claims it'll actually eradicate it out of the body, and it'll leave your normal cells alone. But the problem is the big medical associations, they won't allow it because there's no tests, there's no research and stuff like that. Now, concerning this virus, I'm sure that anyone out there who's got this virus and is in bad shape, they would try anything that comes along the path. I mean, they're taking a chance anyway, you know? And also, whether the virus mutates or not, you know, it's regardless, but they do have something, you know, this hydroxyl chloroquine combined with Z-Pak, I think it's erythromycin, that seems to work. But you also have, I saw another study. I saw another study that said that what do you feel about this? If you alkalize the body, if you get the body's pH level from 7.0 to 7.2, no disease, not cancer, not any virus, not any bacteria can live in that environment. What do you think about that?
In a word, not a great deal. There's a whole bunch of different things you mentioned. We already kind of discussed the hydroxychloroquine and the azithromycin. There's very preliminary studies. They lacked a whole bunch of things, like there weren't enough subjects to make it statistically significant, even if it worked. And the initial study demonstrated a benefit, except that they left out all the people who were transferred to the ICUs because they were dying. And when you added back the people who were